As much as I prod her, Madeline Kolab won't brag. She's not your typical I caught a fish this big kind of person. But then again, she's not a typical anything.
In Gaza, a 16-year-old girl does what no other girls do.
I am the oldest daughter, so I took on the job. And I fish every day.
And an unusual way to find landmines.
Rats are too light to set off landmines. And by the way, our hero rats are way too valuable to actually...
To blow up. Plus, the first soft serve ice cream in Rwanda for people who aren't used to eating much beyond the staples.
Do you have a favorite food?
I don't know. I would say beans and rice and meat.
Around the world with the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. But first, this hour's news. Welcome to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Early next month, the people of southern Sudan will vote on whether to split from the Arab Muslim North. If they vote yes, they'll form their own country. It'll be largely Christian and animist. The Sudanese who live in the U.S. are traveling to special sites to register to vote in the election. More on that story coming up later. But one man from southern Sudan is doing more than voting. Simon Dang, a former slave, has seen the worst of ethnic violence that's torn his country apart. Now he's taking to his feet to deliver a message. Simon has walked from New York City to Washington, D.C., and he's gone barefoot through the halls of Congress. He's telling whoever will listen that without American intervention, Sudan may once again find itself in a full-blown civil war. Emily Johnson joined Simon Dang on the road.
Cars honk and people stop on the sidewalk at the sight of a tall, dark-skinned man at the head of a small procession. An American flag rests on his shoulder. A sign around his neck reads, "Slavery and genocide are unacceptable." Simon Dang has been walking for 3 hours without stopping. He doesn't seem to notice the rain.
The southern Sudanese, we were born on feet. The first thing we have to do is run or walk. Run for our life, walk to look for peace somewhere, and walk even to ask for freedom.
Freedom, coming from Deng, this well-worn word, has fresh meaning. 4 decades ago, at the age of 9, he watched from the bushes as government-backed troops murdered the people of his village in South Sudan. Young Simon was abducted and given as a gift to a family in the north where slavery is still common.
Close your eye and envision yourself in a position where you cannot say no to anything, where all you have to say, yes, yes.
For 3 years, Deng's owners beat him and forced him to do hard labor.
I didn't have a friend. My friend is my hope and my patience in God, assuming that one day, sun will come out from nowhere.
And miraculously, it did. One day, Deng had a chance encounter with a man who had distinctive and familiar scars on his forehead, the scars of Deng's own native Shilluk tribe in the south. The man smuggled the boy home. Years later, Deng moved back to the north to begin training as a swimmer. His dark skin set him apart from the Arabs there. It got him thrown out of city pools, so he swam in the Nile River instead. In 1983, just before civil war broke out between the north and the south, he became a national swimming champion and an advocate for the south. When that got too dangerous, he fled to the U.S. Now, he works as a Coney Island lifeguard and moonlights as an activist.
We're going to Washington's to ask them to dismantle the ticking time bomb before it went off.
That time bomb is a referendum, scheduled for January 9th when the South will decide whether to vote for independence. It's likely Southerners will vote to form their own country, but many people fear the North won't let them go peacefully. Deng is not alone on his walk to Washington. Supporter Abdul-Jabbar Adam is going the entire distance with him. After an especially long day, Adam's feet blistered so badly he couldn't put his shoes back on. His solution? Keep on walking. In flip-flops.
All my toys are talking to me, stop. They're just saying, stop walking. But I'm determined to get into the capital.
Outside the White House, Deng claps and dances with more than 100 cheering Sudanese. Smiles flash beneath various tribal scars, and women swirl their colorful print dresses. They've come from all over the U.S. to rally for Abyei, a flashpoint region between the border of North and South Sudan that's rich in both oil and water. Deng's plan is to visit the offices of all 100 senators and all 435 representatives, barefoot.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Senator Kerry, right?
Deng's weathered feet pad across the Senate building's plush carpets as he crosses from office to office. The U.S. already supports the referendum, but Deng wants more. He wants strong diplomatic pressure on Sudan's government to respect the vote. Here, he's facing another long road.
I can deliver it for you.
Thank you very much.
No problem. Okay. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Robert.
Afterward, on a sunny Washington street, supporter and fellow Southerner Kwakwan Deng says he has known many Sudanese who were enslaved. But the way Simon has used his experience to effect change is rare.
And it's not easy to admit because the fear, the shame, the suffering they've gone through. We pray that no harm comes through his way because we know that he's also a target.
In fact, Simon Deng may have been a target right after he made another walk in 2006. He was struck from behind by a car outside his home in Harlem. It may have been an accident, but Deng doesn't think so. He had just walked 300 miles of busy roads with no problems.
And then suddenly, in a place where I had been living for 18 years, and almost got killed in that place. What a coincidence.
Deng spent 2 months in the hospital with broken ribs and 2 collapsed lungs. But he insists he's not afraid. The situation is so urgent, he says, that he's afraid not to act. For the World Vision Report, I'm Emily Johnson in Washington, D.C.
All over the U.S., Sudanese refugees are registering to vote in this historic referendum for the South's independence. That includes the thousands of so-called lost boys who arrived in the U.S. in 2001. Many of them settled in Phoenix, when it was a fast-growing city flush with entry-level jobs. Now, lost boys from all over the western U.S. are flooding into Arizona. They're registering so they can cast their absentee votes. Devin Brown reports.
The registration center in Phoenix is one of only 8 in the country, and it feels today, on the eve of the registration deadline, a bit like the site of a family reunion.
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
One of these men, Jokom Riak from Salt Lake City, is happy to find that the person registering him this afternoon is an old friend of his.
Oh, this guy, I've known him since 1987, when we were a young boy known as today as the Lost Boy of Sudan.
The guy he's talking about is one of the main voter registration organizers in Phoenix. His name is Toot Gatiel. And like Jokom, Toot is all smiles talking about his old friend.
Hi, we live together in the camp. Well, we came to the United States. Best friend of mine, we used to play soccer together and go to school together.
This was all years ago, after the boys fled Sudan, but before they came to the United States, that 10-year period in the 90s when the Lost Boys lived mainly in refugee camps in Kenya. These men and women have spent almost their entire lives outside of their own country. In fact, they've never had their own country. For as long as they can remember, South Sudan, which is mainly black and Christian, has been ruled by the North, which is mainly Arab and Muslim. Peace agreements ended the violence there in 2005, but even still, Toot says his family back in Sudan doesn't live in full peace.
Nothing has been built, no good hospital, no good roads, because the government just want to take the resources and build them in the other part of the country.
This is why the referendum is so important. It will determine for the Lost Boys in Phoenix and Salt Lake City and all of the diaspora whether or not they'll ever have a country to go home to. The coordinator of the registration center, Joseph Onek, says that if Southern Sudan secedes, he and many others will go back immediately.
Imagine it's a small country. Well, it's not. It's a new country. So they want to be part of the history by being there, develop it, and let it move forward.
One of these people is Toot. Toot is 6'6". He's fluent in 5 languages, he's getting his bachelor's at Arizona State in geology and space exploration, and now he wants to go home and develop his country's oil reserves. He is, by any means, exactly the kind of young leader a new country would want. And Toot knows this. He's even been a leader in his own community since coming to this country.
That's what I do, and even I do it when I was in the camp, too. I help many of them.
In some ways, Toot was actually born to be a leader. His father was the chief of their village. And Toot was his dad's 10th child, but he says this doesn't matter. What matters is who his dad liked the most.
Because he liked me most and I looked like him too.
Toot looks like him now, but he didn't really as a kid. And the only reason he knows this is because of an extraordinary archive put together by Phoenix's Lost Boys Center. The center helped to organize the thousands of records and photos and interviews the Lost Boys gave to volunteers when they first left Sudan as kids. They put the archive online. For most of the refugees, it's the only photo they have of themselves as children. When they look up their records, it's the first time they've seen themselves as children. Some of them, like Toot, were pleased with what he saw.
I like it. I was a little chubby, but now I'm still skinny and tall.
Others, like Kuala Wan, who directs the AZ Lost Boys Center, said the records were bittersweet to see.
Because it reminded me at the time and the people that I lost in process when I went to that camp.
His record lists his relatives, attacks from people in other tribes and animals he faced on the journey, and the fact that he had both malaria and scabies as a kid. Disparate details of his life in a country he now wants to be independent and at peace.
You know, I went through what I went through, and I don't blame anybody for it. But I don't want it to happen to any kid in the world. And I don't want it to happen again to any child in Sudan.
To this end, Kual takes the upcoming referendum very seriously. He even plans to bring his baby with him when he casts his ballot, just so his whole family will be a part of this moment. Many of the Sudanese refugees who come to register in Phoenix seem to carry a similar level of commitment, often arriving in full suits and formal dresses. Others drove for days, like Nyoko Akwari, also from Utah. He arrives exhausted but ready. Toot takes his fingerprint and first and last name.
I want you to verify if your name is correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's correct, Salt Lake City. That's correct.
And then he offers him a hearty handshake for making the trek.
Congratulations. Congratulations, you guys.
At the end of the registration here in Phoenix, organizers say they have nearly 1,000 refugees signed up to vote next month on January 9th. For the World Vision Report, I'm Devin Brown in Phoenix.
You need two guys to fly a kite, Zabi says. One takes the string and the other steers the kite. You have to be careful when you're in charge of the spool. You have to keep feeding string once a fight starts. You can't stop. If you do, you lose.
In Afghanistan, the serious business of kite flying. That's coming up.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. For decades, most of the images coming out of Afghanistan have been bloody and brutal. But a best-selling novel called The Kite Runner gave the world a different picture of Afghanistan. Author Khaled Hosseini introduced the world to the colorful kites that fill the Afghan skies. The kites were a metaphor in the book for Afghans' past and continuing struggle. And as Don Duncan reports from Kabul, the kites offer everyone, no matter how poor, an escape. At least for a few hours at the end of each day.
In South and East Afghanistan, firefights and ambushes are still a big part of daily life. But in relatively stable Kabul, battles of a different kind are happening in the sky. Bright colors dart across the evening sky of Kabul, as they have done intermittently for centuries. While the colors may catch the eye, the key to all the aerial drama is the string. It's made of tough material and laced with crushed glass, designed to slice through other kites or snap their strings. A kite's life is short in Afghanistan. A flyer can easily go through 10 or 20 a day. And no matter how brief, many of these kites' journeys start here, in Kabul's busy market street, Strand Bazaar. 13-year-old Ahmed Hassani has 25 cents, enough money for one kite today. He weaves his way through the market looking for a deal. Flying kites puts a good feeling into me, he says, but if I lose the kite fight, then I have to go and buy another, and that is bad. A winning kite not only depends on the skill of its pilot, its size and the strength of string used are also crucial, and all these are put together in the small workshop and kite stalls of Strand Bazaar. Tamim's stall is typical of Strand Bazaar, narrow, long, dark and chock full of piles of paper kites and spools of thread. He's dipping his thumb into a brass pot of glue and applying it to the edges of paper kites.
3 times, then here to here.
Then comes the bamboo frame, which he bends into place, and he runs thread along the edges to strengthen the kite.
Then we are use the thread, because it is for doubling.
Kites sell from 25 cents for the smallest models to up to $100 for large, hand-decorated models, usually going to tourists.
Now your kite is ready.
Ahmed, who has been joined by his kite-flying buddy, Zabi, combs the stalls until they've found the kite they want. It's a small, diamond-shaped one, buttercup yellow, tiny but hopefully tough. They quickly replenish their spool with thread on the sidewalk. Then the boys find an open space next to the market to get the flight going. It's a team effort. You need two guys to fly a kite, Zabi says. One takes the string and the other steers the kite. You have to be careful when you're in charge of the spool. You have to keep feeding string once a fight starts. You can't stop. If you do, you lose. Once kids like Zabi and Ahmed are confident in their skills, they join the real fracas, up on the dramatic hilltops that surround Kabul, where hundreds of kites duel it out until dark, nightly. Young and old, rich and poor, all of Afghanistan's ethnic groups can be found up here with their eyes trained to the sky. And things on the ground seem to be as mixed and fluid as the colours that dance up in the sky. A kind of food chain establishes itself. Those who manage to hang on to their kites or can afford a generous reserve of kites dive into the battle up above. And those who have lost theirs or can't afford any more scrum it out down below to pick up the war booty that falls out of the sky. These are the kite runners. 15-year-old kite runner Imran Khan Dohil is in the thick of it.
I have to catch because my money is finished. But I don't like the catching of kites. I only want to buy the kites.
But beggars can't be choosers in this game, and in the next scrum of the kite runners, Imran emerges victorious. The kite gets a quick repair job with tape and is back up for the fight within minutes. And then back down again. Another kite string has severed Imran's.
Yeah, I've gone, sorry.
He lost the kite.
Kite flyer Tahir Shah remembers a time when shells used to rain down from these hills during Afghanistan's civil war and Soviet occupation. Now he's happy to see thousands of colorful kites float above them.
People of Afghanistan have very more, they take away a very dangerous time in Afghanistan. Now they want to enjoyment in Afghanistan. The time has come that people come here and for enjoyment.
With the flick of a wrist, emperors become paupers and emperors once again in the skies above Kabul. At least that's how it is up here on the city's hilltop. For the World Vision Report, this is Don Duncan in Kabul.
Those kite-running boys get a respite from the war, but for women and girls, there's often no let-up from the violence. It's coming even from within their own families. Journalist Elizabeth Rubin has written an article for the December issue of National Geographic all about what it's like to be female in Afghanistan. She joins us from New York. Thanks for joining us, Elizabeth.
Sure, my pleasure.
You've spent a lot of time reporting in Afghanistan over the years, and you have a pretty good feel for what it's like to be a woman there. To get a picture of what you've seen, why don't we just start with a story, if we could? The story of the young woman you wrote about in your National Geographic article, who just happened to fall in love with the wrong man.
Right. She fell in love with a boy in eastern Afghanistan, and she comes from a very, very prominent, wealthy tribe. And her father did not want her marrying or having anything to do with this man, but she ran off with him. And in his anger, shame, pride, it's hard to distinguish them, he killed the boy that she married. He killed his wife, her mother. He killed several of the other brothers of the boy that she married, so the sons of that family. And he has about $100,000 reward promised for anybody who brings back the body of his daughter. It's a very extreme case of the extremes to which fathers will go to protect what they feel is their honor being shamed. And that's the whole very sad position of women in Afghanistan, is that they don't represent themselves. They represent a value, a commodity in the family, which is their honor.
This case really does sound extreme, but how many women, or what percentage of Afghan women, are subjected to some kind of abuse or mistreatment as women because of this code of honor?
I mean, it's always very difficult to give percentages, and you have to also distinguish between different areas in the country. In the Pashtun areas, and particularly outside of Kabul, and the Pashtun areas cover about half, if not a little bit more, of the country, that is where the girl's honor is everything. And there are cases, of course, where, you know, they can be allowed to marry somebody that wasn't chosen by the family. But by and large, girls are promised at very young ages to families, often for money. Sometimes they're used for a debt. And they live in the house of the husband. And the thing that can happen that's quite tragic is that they can become, particularly in the rural areas, basically a slave to that family. You know, in India, there's a joke about this, and there's been a soap opera for years called Because Mother-in-Law Was Once a Daughter-in-Law. The mother-in-law becomes part of the abuser, so that it's not just the sons, it's not just the father, it's not just the men. It's a way of viewing what the new wife is meant to do and the role in the family. And that's where the abuse can become so bad that you have these instances of girls, they can't go on.
The one story you told us about, the rather extreme story, was about a woman in a Pashtun family, which is the largest and most conservative group in rural Afghanistan. What is it about Pashtun beliefs that enables these things to happen?
Well, I think that it's a couple of things. You know, there's the values of the Pashtun are women, gold, and land. And a man's honor accumulates by the amount he has of each three.
What does that have to do with honor?
Your honor is about how much wealth you can show. The bigger your hospitality, the more honor you accrue. And the sanctity of women, the virginity of women, and the fidelity of women, that too is about honor. You know, somehow the shame of a girl having sex out of marriage or looking at the wrong guy affects their honor. It's part of the commodity of the family.
So the only thing that provokes these mother-in-laws and brothers and fathers to go after the women is if they do something that's considered sexually dishonorable? Or what other kinds of things can a woman not do?
No, if it was only that, you know, that would be a relief. But unfortunately, what often happens, a young girl that I met in the burn hospital in Jalalabad, in the burn ward there, she had been married into a family living in Pakistan, very poor, and she was treated like a slave by everybody. She did nothing. She was 14 years old. She was married. She was faithful. She did whatever they told her. And they still used to beat her. And to understand where that aggression and violence comes towards a girl is a great mystery. You know, is it their own poverty, powerlessness? Is it 30 years of a degradation of a society that's, you know, only known war and kind of struggle to survive for the basics? These are all huge questions that are very hard to answer. But the abuse is not just for a woman who's strayed. The abuse is for women who have done nothing except get married.
And how widely accepted is this kind of abuse that the women go through inside their homes?
I think that a lot of girls are just taught that this is their fate from the time they're born. You know, there are some changes happening in Kabul for all women, but particularly for the Pashtuns. In the rural areas, which, you know, is where most people live, it's a very guarded life. Many of them never leave the compound where they live.
it seems that more women are finding a way out by really hurting themselves, by burning. What is this about, and what is it that they're doing?
Well, it's pretty crude. Oftentimes they'll use the petrol from a gas lamp and pour it on their bodies and set a flame to it so that they actually burn. And it's a very painful, horrible way to try to kill yourself. The trend started in Iran and moved to Herat, and there's been a sort of explosion of girls burning themselves. That's where the burn hospital is.
Did you visit this hospital?
I visited the hospital in Jalalabad, and the first time you go to such a place, it's an overwhelming sensory experience where you think you're going to vomit and faint because the smell of burnt flesh is very powerful. And a woman, a human rights worker, Afghan that I was with, she said, you know, it took many of them 10 visits to be able to not get sick. Mm. And it's heartbreaking because oftentimes you meet these girls and they're still alive and they tell you the story of what happened, and it's the first time that they've actually gotten any sympathy, you know, is when they're nearly dead. And many of them do die because the burns are so pervasive.
Can you tell us about any of the girls who survived and what they told you?
One of them was a girl who kept trying to run away from her situation. Her father had married her to a religious man, believing that she would be safe and taken good care of. And she was taken to Pakistan, where she was married to this mullah who used to beat her terribly, and so did her mother-in-law. And she was often made to sleep in the barn with, you know, the animals. And her life was really hellacious. And one day she just gave up. And she took the petrol from a gas lamp, threw it on herself, set herself alight. And then when they found her and put the flames out, then they left her in the barn to just kind of rot. And it took 2 days for her father to get there and brought her back to Afghanistan. And I think she survived, you know, for maybe a month.
Ugh. Well, for the women who do survive these suicide attempts, what happens when they go back home? Is there any way for their lives to be restored? What do they do?
It really depends on the family. Sometimes the parents take them back and they live with their parents for the rest of their lives, probably, because it'll be very hard for them to get married again. Oftentimes there are some outside organizations that come in and teach them a trade, and that can support them. But it really depends on their parents. That will determine what kind of life they have afterwards.
You know, Elizabeth, back in 2002, there were so many stories post-Taliban that things for women were changing. I mean, we all thought, wow, women in Afghanistan are making a turn for the better, but it sure doesn't sound like it.
You know, I don't think that's really true. Let's look at the other side of things, which is that you have an enormous number of women in a parliament. You have women appearing on television as actresses and singers and news announcers, and, you know, a young Pashtun girl that I also wrote about, 19 years old, her family disowned her, and she's the star of this soap opera. It's very hard for her, but she could never have done that 15 years ago. So it's true that in some ways, the gains make the frustration of life as an Afghan woman that much harder to accept. Because there was so much hope, because there were so many promises made, the fact that it still remains so difficult is psychologically more difficult to bear.
And that's very interesting. You would think with all of these advances for women that the women who are making it and have a voice would be fighting really hard or starting organizations or movements to stop the bad treatment of most of these other women in rural areas.
It's a very slow process. You know, men are not just going to suddenly overnight decide, oh, we're going to let our women have more power than we do and change their way of life overnight, especially when on top of everything else, they're being bombed from the sky. Their lives are upside down. And now they're being asked to change their way of life with regard to their women overnight. But then there are huge programs. Women are doing radio programs out in the countryside, so are men, teaching about domestic violence, teaching about birth control, about education. All sorts of messaging is going on in these programs to try and turn things around. It's just very slow.
Elizabeth Rubin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Peggy.
Elizabeth Rubin is a writer for National Geographic magazine. When the Taliban was in power in Afghanistan, any kind of public performance of music was banned. But women faced the harshest penalty. They could be maimed or murdered. So too could anyone who taught women to sing or play music. Many still believe that any kind of performance by a woman is a crime against Islam. That's a young singer named Farida Tarana. She's from Herat, and a few years ago, she was the first woman from that very conservative city to make it to the top 10 in a show similar to our American Idol. It's called Afghan Star. But Farida paid a steep price for her public singing success. She faced death threats, and she was driven out of her city. Some of this is beginning to change. There are new music schools opening up for women, though mostly the women attend in secret. Since she sang on Afghan Star, Farida Tarana has changed as well. She's become a politician. Her fame as a singer helped get her elected to the Kabul Provincial Council. Farida won the second highest number of votes out of more than 500 candidates. In a country like Afghanistan, change can be glacial. But then sometimes, it just happens.
Is me. I think it's apparent that I need to rethink my life a little bit. I can't help myself. I like good food, okay? And good food is hard for a rat to find.
It wouldn't be so hard to find if you weren't so picky.
I don't want to eat garbage, Dad.
Coming up, from Ratatouille to Charlotte's Web, fictional rats can be cute, sometimes cunning, and some can even cook. But real rats are saving lives. Stay tuned for more on the World Vision Report. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Women in Afghanistan are slowly breaking new ground, and so are women in Gaza. Sometimes it happens purely out of necessity. The Gaza Strip borders the Mediterranean Sea, and a lot of people there fish. Men, that is. But now, Gaza's first fisherwoman has taken to the seas. This is easier said than done in a place like Gaza. Gender roles there are strict, and the governing Islamist group Hamas imposes rules on the way the women can dress and behave in public. In this last installment of our series from Gaza, Daniel Estrin profiles a Palestinian fisherwoman at work on the shores.
As much as I prod her, Madeline Kolab won't brag. She's not your typical "I caught a fish this big" kind of person. But then again, she's not a typical anything. Madeline is 16 years old, one of the youngest members of Gaza's fishing community.
When I was 6 years old, I used to go with my father fishing. But when I turned 13, my father became sick and couldn't go alone. I am the oldest daughter, so I took on the job, and I fish every day.
She's up at 4:30 a.m. getting ready. She gets to the shore by 6 a.m., and that's when I meet her. She's a devout Muslim, so her fishing clothes are the same as her regular clothes, headscarf and long skirt over pants. When she gets to the beach, she gets right to work. She and her 13-year-old brother Kayed push a small wooden raft off the shore and into the water. Her father watches from the beach, calling out directions. Further out in the sea, they stand up on the flat boat in warrior position and row with long wooden paddles. Watching Madeline reminds me of those Egyptian hieroglyphics of the confident pharaoh standing on his raft on the Nile with a hunting spear in hand. Madeline paddles to the net she laid out the night before, kneels, and pulls it in. Then she and her brother come back to shore and start to pick the fish out of the net. Madeline's dad, Mohammed, sits on the sand in sweatpants and a t-shirt. and kisses the heads of the crabs and the little fish.
Barak, alhamdulillah.
Thank God, he says. It's a blessing. Muhammad used to work as a fisherman, selling his catch in Gaza's markets. But an illness ended his career. It was a stroke. Now he sits on the shore and guides his daughter, who's providing for the family. Last year, after ninth grade, Madeline quit school to fish full-time.
I can't go fishing and go to school at the same time. I have to go fishing. If I didn't, I don't know what would happen to my family.
Whatever she catches is what her family eats. She doesn't have a lot of nets, so she doesn't catch enough fish to sell. Sometimes she has to dive down and untangle the nets. She can dive 17 feet. This work feeds her family. Fishing in Gaza can be dangerous. The Israeli Navy doesn't let boats go more than a few miles offshore. The idea is to prevent weapons smuggling and attacks on Israel from the sea. Madeline's boat isn't big enough to go out that far in the sea. But she often hears gunfire when the Navy fires a round of warning shots. She says she's gotten used to it. That determination has made an impression on Reem, her 13-year-old sister, who wakes up early every day before school to help. She is brave and strong, and she's not afraid of the sea, Reem says. I don't know any other girl like her. Nearby, there is an elderly fisherman named Abu Zaid, who's sorting the fish from his own net, and he is not happy. Abu Zaid says, if my daughter would start fishing, I would slaughter her. It's an embarrassment for us Palestinians that a woman would go fishing. There are men here. Madeline says she hears this kind of thing a lot.
Lots of people are surprised to see me fishing. They say, why is a girl fishing? She shouldn't do it. But no one has helped us. No one has given us a dime or a loaf of bread. Going fishing is better than begging.
There's another young fisherman on the shore named Mohammed Issiam. He's silently sorting his fish while Madeline is folding her net. When she leaves the shore to go home, he begins to talk to me in my translator.
When I first saw her fish, I was astonished. And actually, she is very good. She can dive more than we can.
Yes, of course.
So she should teach you?
No, not to teach him.
Here's the thing about Madeline Kolab. She doesn't mean to rock the boat. She respects Gaza's traditional way of life, and so far, the Hamas government is respecting her. And whether the other fishermen like it or not, Gaza's first fisherwoman has upped the bar. Not because she's a girl, because she's good. For the World Vision Report, I'm Daniel Estrin, the shores of the Mediterranean in the Gaza Strip.
Landmines have long been a part of war, and they're especially feared because they maim and kill people for years after conflicts are over. There are ways to find landmines. People use metal detectors, radar, even dogs. But there's another way that may surprise you: rats. It turns out they're smart enough to be taught to sniff out landmines, and Bart Waitchens loves them. He was obsessed with rodents as a child, playing with them, even breeding and selling them. So it's no surprise he founded the organization Hero Rats. It's based in Tanzania. Bart admits that rats aren't everyone's favorite animal.
Often people think that rats are critters and they are vermin, but that has a lot to do with the bad image our friends received transmitting plague, which is, by the way, more because of the fleas and because of the rats.
Right, the fleas and the lice, it wasn't really the rats.
Well, yeah, well, rats were also involved there, of course. But when kept well as a pet and well taken care of, rats are incredibly social, intelligent animals, and they're really lovable to interact with.
Oh, that might be a stretch, lovable, but I'll buy that from coming from you. So you raised rats, you bred them and raised them and sold them to pet stores. And then as you got a little older, you learned about the problem of landmines in Africa. When did you find out about landmines?
Well, as a design engineer, I focused on appropriate technologies for developing countries. And looking into the most challenging problems, I looked into the landmine problem. Wherever landmines exist, they hamper development. And in addition to killing and maiming people, they cause fear and passive attitudes. So removing landmines and releasing land always help for regional and national development.
So what made you think that rats might be able to solve the landmine problem?
I noticed in the analysis that most populations, indigenous populations, are totally dependent on expensive imported expertise. I started looking from the viewpoint of a subsistence farmer and from the resources he has or she has at hand. And rats are almost everywhere. Now, I was inspired by the work done by mine detection dogs, but I also saw their weaknesses. Dogs are sensitive to tropical diseases. They are quite expensive to train, and it requires high levels of skills in the operators. These three aspects in particular are not so important with rats. They are easy to train, they are cheap, and they are quite robust and resistant to tropical diseases.
Hero rats, what do they look like?
Well, they're large. They have a tail like most rats have. They look actually like real rats, but quite large in size, the size of a small cat, I would say.
A small cat? A rat the size of a cat? And they're smart and valuable and socialized. I'm trying to change my thinking now about a rat. This is a rat I would like. So let's talk a little bit about how it actually works. How do rats find landmines?
They detect these explosives by their olfactory sense. They have an extremely keen sense of smell. And we train them. We actually positively reinforce their behavior of indicating wherever there's a mine buried, and they do that by scratching on the soil. When an animal scratches the soil on top of a landmine, we give it a click sound, and it comes for a food reward.
How do you actually train them how to get a reward for sniffing explosives? How would you? Obviously, the rat has to be pretty smart to do this.
Well, but they are pretty smart, and they are so easy to train. So initially, we socialize the animals. Once they open the eyes, we wean them from the litter, and we take very well care of them. Soon, the animals learn that humans are friends. In a next phase, we use a metal clicker to associate a click sound with a food reinforcer, a food reward. And the animals, soon they associate this, and then we use this clicker sound to reinforce the behavior of scratching on the soil whenever they approach a landmine. And by the way, there are two lights to set off these landmines. Often people think, yeah, great, then we get rid of the rats at once and the landmine at once.
So if the rat runs, you envision the rat running across a landmine and it, and the rat blowing up with a landmine, but that's not how it works.
Yeah, that's not how it works. Rats are too light to set off landmines. And by the way, our hero rats are way too valuable to actually...
To blow up. Yeah, how much does it cost to train one of these rats?
Yes, it costs about 6,000 euros to fully train a rat. Mm. And in comparison, this is only a quarter of the price of a mine detection dog.
You can see why you wouldn't want the rat to hit the landmine and blow up with it. So the rats are too light. All they do is scratch the surface and then a human can go take care of the landmine.
Exactly. Wherever rats indicate, humans follow up with a metal detector and dig out the mines and neutralize them on the spot.
What would I see when a rat is actually doing the demining work?
What you would see in the field is rats in a harness tethered to a search line. And the animal moves up and down a suspected box, and wherever it finds a mine, it will scratch the soil and come for a food reward. Systematically, the box or suspected area is searched, and rats can do that in an incredibly fast time. As an example, where two manual deminers take an entire day to clear 200 square meters, two rats with their trainers can do the same area in an hour and a half only.
Do you still play with them like you did when you were a boy?
Well, I don't have so much time anymore to play with them, but I have a few favorites.
What are their names?
There's Evans, for instance. Well, Evans is really very socialized, very well socialized animal. I use him often whenever we have to present an animal.
Really? What is it about Evan that you like?
Well, the fact that he's, again, very well socialized. Animals bond with humans, and For a rat, even if they may bond less than, for instance, a dog or a cat, still they can be very nice creatures and you can build a relationship with a rat.
Bart, how successful have you been at converting any previous rat haters to rat lovers after they've seen them in action?
Well, I think we are very successful in converting rat haters to rat lovers. Many people who come and visit our program first have like a not so nice idea about rats, but once they see the animals at work and they see the life-saving action they can do and they can be involved with, it is so beautiful to see rats working in symbiosis with humans and together saving lives.
Yeah, well, I think you've convinced me. I'm not sure I'd touch one or pet one, but I have a much greater respect for rats having spoken with you.
I didn't say that people are now keen to touch our rats and so on. And of course, many people remain reluctant, but they become enthusiastic about the life-saving work our hero rats do.
All right, Bart, thank you so much.
Well, thank you too. Very nice talking to you.
That was Bart Wachens. He's founder of Hero Rats. We spoke with him from a studio in Tanzania. For more information about these Hero Rats or to see photos, go to our website at worldvisionreport.org. As a little tribute to those of you mired in the freezing cold right now, we're closing the show with that other white icy stuff. Ice cream. This all-American treat debuted in the Rwandan countryside recently, and in a land where the simplest meal is often a luxury, this soft serve is a real treat. Gina Moore reports from Butare.
Mary Louise Ngabira has something many Americans don't, a memory of her first taste of ice cream.
I was so shocked. It was very cold. I didn't know what it was, and I couldn't get the taste.
Americans love their ice cream, but for Rwandans, it's an acquired taste, a taste Nantine Muganera doubted from the start.
The first time I tasted ice cream, it was so cold that I didn't think it was edible.
Now, these two women make a living in Butare, selling the treat that once perplexed them. They work at Nzozi and Ziza, an ice cream shop whose name means sweet dreams.
Bonsoir.
Bonsoir. Ça va, les filles?
Hard-packed ice cream has been in Rwanda's groceries and restaurants for years, but Nzozi and Ziza is the country's first destination ice cream parlor, and the only place with soft serve. It's not far from Rwanda's biggest college campus. Nzozi and Ziza is an offshoot of a New York company called Blue Marble. Blue Marble's Brooklyn ice creameries are in a different kind of world, one where most idle pedestrians have expendable income, and the palate plays favorites. Not so in Rwanda.
Do you have a favorite food?
I don't know, we say beans and rice and meat. Pretty much that.
That's Jean Gracienu Isava, who's from Kigali. And he's laughing because in Rwanda, the idea of a favorite food is ridiculous. You eat once a day if you can, because you need to, and you don't have a lot of choices. Beans, sweet potatoes, a starchy root called cassava. There's just nothing fun about food here. In fact, if you want to celebrate in Rwanda, you drink. Even at Umuganura, the harvest festival.
For us, they celebrate with what? Alcohol and milk. No food.
Uisava is an armchair anthropologist. He grew up in Rwanda and now works in the U.S. My questions about food here intrigued him, so he asked his family why Rwandans keep quiet about food. His cousin told him,
A respected person cannot talk about food, and I can see in her face something negative about talking about food.
That's not just true in public. It's even true inside Rwandan homes.
You know, in American culture, when like time for dinner would be, you scream and say, "Dinner is ready?" No. When dinner is ready, I will go to my sister's ear and say, "My mom is calling you." I will never say, "Oh, it's time for dinner." No, never, never, never. You never like comment about food.
It's considered bad manners?
Worst manners. Not bad, just the worst.
There's also economics at work. In a country where roughly 80% of the people live on about a dollar a day, no meal is taken for granted. So the idea of culinary indulgence is literally foreign. A large cone at Nzozi and Ziza costs the same as a quart of milk or 2 pounds of potatoes. The number of people who can afford the trade-off is small. Yvonne Avani, a student, sees another cultural hurdle, gender. Finishing a large dish of vanilla on Nzozi and Ziza's outdoor patio, he warns me that he and his male friends are exceptional consumers.
In Rwanda, people think ice cream is for girls because it's so sweet. Men prefer to have beer. That's more macho.
But there's another reason, I've heard, that young men in Butare like ice cream.
Is ice cream a good way to start a romance with a girl?
Yes, exactly. It's a nice way to start chatting with a girl because you eat it so slowly. Unlike beer, which makes you lose your mind, so you say all these nonsensical things and you end up not getting the girl.
It's been 6 months since Nzozi and Ziza opened, and people are warming up to its cold treats. It helps that ice cream is really just frozen milk, and milk has been celebrated in Rwanda for centuries. And it helps that it's the kind of surprise that impresses a lady on a date or excites kids who've earned good grades. And at least one customer on a busy Thursday night thinks ice cream represents even more.
I think it fits in our vision of, you know, going forward, moving forward, meeting other people, other cultures. Ice cream fits right in.
In Butare, Rwanda, I'm Gina Moore for the World Vision Report.
And that's it for this week. Remember, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can download a podcast at our website. The address again, worldvisionreport.org. I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.